Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 58, featuring my captivating conversation with Nanette Diaz-Barragan, a member of the United States House of Representatives from California's 44th Congressional District. Congresswoman Barragan answers questions from Freedom Writer students and shares her empowering journey to the U.S. House of Representatives as a first-generation American. We also discuss her heart-wrenching experience meeting those children locked up in cages at the southern border of the United States and the horrific attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Congresswoman Barragan's stories are incredibly inspiring, and I hope she leaves you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Today's guest, Congresswoman Nanette Barragan, has a story not all that different from the Freedom Writers. She grew up in Southern California as a child of immigrant parents and found her success through discovering the power of education. After obtaining her undergraduate degree from UCLA and attending law school at USC, Nanette had a strong desire to give back to her community. After serving her local community for many years and sitting on the Freedom Writers Board, Nanette became the representative for California's 44th Congressional District in 2016. As a member of Congress, Congresswoman Barragan visited the family separation facilities on the United States southern border and saw firsthand the disheartening conditions these children lived in, inhumane cages. Congresswoman Barragan is now using her position as the chair of the House's Subcommittee on Border Security, Facilitation, and Operations to enact meaningful change in the United States immigration policies. Congressman Barragan also remains committed to tackling climate change, fighting for affordable healthcare, and ensuring safe, clean air and water. During the COVID-19 pandemic, she became a strong voice in supporting minority communities hit hardest by the coronavirus. Her dedication to service should act as an inspiration to anyone who dreams of defying the odds and following their heart. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Congresswoman Nanette Barragan. Congressman Nanette Diaz-Barragan, I feel like this is a pinch me moment for me because I remember sitting around a table with like-minded folk and you announcing to the universe that you were gonna run for Congress. And so for ordinary people who believe they can do extraordinary things, what does it take for someone like yourself to declare that you're gonna run for Congress and actually see that dream actualized?
Well, timing and opportunity is, I think, key, but hard work and just making sure that we instill in our young people that they could be anything they want. And when I was a kid growing up, my parents were immigrants. And never did I think that I would run for Congress one day. As an intern, I thought maybe I could work for a president one day. But it's amazing what happens when you pursue an education, you go to school, you study, you network, and you meet folks and work hard. So I tell our little, I say young girls, and I'll say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And they'll say, I want to be a teacher, I want to be a nurse. I said, that's so great, but how about President of the United States? And you see their face light up and smile. We need to tell all our young kids that early on to instill that in them.
To be a congressional member under a vice president who is a woman, what is that like now when you do encourage little girls that you could be a congressional member or you could be the vice president or the president? Do you feel like now it's much more tangible?
I think having a woman there lets them visualize it better and easier so that they could see it in the flesh. And I think that's just so inspiring for our young girls to see that. But we got a little ways to go. We got to get, you know, a woman into the presidential slot. But we're at a good place now. And to see it be a woman of color just adds a whole nother dynamic and a layer to it that is really amazing. Especially in my district where you have almost 90% Latino African American.
Congressman Barragan, I love that you are a first generation American, a member of Congress, and as a political junkie, I love turning on my Sunday morning news shows and seeing you talk to folks like Jake Tapper on CNN State of the Union about what it means to be a Latina and be a member of Congress.
What do you make of it?
You know, I'm proud to be the daughter of immigrants from Mexico. I'm proud to bring a perspective and an experience to Congress in my policy decision making. And that's what the diversity of the Democratic Party does. And I'm proud that we have more women in Congress and more women of color in Congress.
Nanette, can you explain to our audience from around the globe what it means to be a first-generation American?
So for me, first-generation is my parents immigrated here and I was first born here. But with that comes a lot of heavy responsibility, especially when you're in Congress, because I see it as a way to represent my culture, my heritage, our communities, not just here locally, but across the country. But the experiences that you bring, the experiences of our young people today, what they're going through, their family life, their childhood, their struggles, will all help them down the line when they're at the table. And we need them at the table to be part of our policymakers and our decision makers. So it's your time, right? It's your time for our young people. They are our future leaders. So they can bring that experience with them.
You know, as an English teacher, I fixate on the power of words, and I hate how certain words can make people feel less than or marginalized. And I think when you and I were both in school, we would hear words like illegal, which just make me cringe. And I prefer the term undocumented. So I know that that term undocumented is very dear to you personally. So can you tell our audience what the dignity of using the word undocumented means rather than calling someone an illegal immigrant?
Yeah, you know, this is something that is, it's very personal, given that, you know, I have family who's undocumented. And I like to just remind people, nobody's illegal. People may not have the documentation, but, you know, these are people and we should treat people that way. And so we hear it a lot in committees in Congress. My Republican counterparts will use the term in a derogatory way to try to invoke a vision of criminality. And when you think about it, you know, immigrants built this country, and there are processes for immigrants to come, apply for asylum, and those now are being criminalized. And people need to understand it is completely legal to present yourself at a port of entry and say you want to apply for asylum because you're escaping violence or some other condition, some other circumstances that you're going through. So the word is really used many times these days to characterize immigrants in a negative light. So it's something that we've been working on trying to eliminate.
Congressman Berrigan, I know that you've been to these detention centers and visited the immigrants who wanted to come to our country in earnest, but instead were put in cages. I know that you've been interviewed on countless television programs about those visits.
So please tell our viewers, what did you hear from the detainees at the Irwin County facility?
They were telling the stories of themselves going to see a doctor because they were having maybe pain, and then being given injections they didn't even know about. And this is a human rights abuse. And I spoke to the inspector general who advises that everything's going to be investigated and even criminal charges will be looked at as necessary.
Nanette, what makes me sad is this dehumanizing rhetoric that we often hear that is so insensitive and harkens stereotypes, often is used to justify these horrific detention centers. And that leads me to my next question by Stephanie Santiago, who is an undergraduate student at the University of California, Irvine. And she asks, Congresswoman Bargan, how do you feel about the portrayal of immigrants on the news platforms that are false or unfactual and spread negative stereotypes and policies?
Well, it's very hurtful. And it doesn't help our community. We need to unite and we need to value immigrants and what they bring to the table and to really to our everyday life. When you get to know immigrants, when they're your neighbors, when they're your friends, I think you have a different perception. And so if you look closely, you may not even realize that the person who is making sure that you are stocking your shelves at the grocery store may be immigrants. Maybe the doctor in the hospital where you're getting care, or the medical staff, a lot of them these days are immigrants. We wouldn't have food on the table because you have people working in the farms, picking the food that we so value right now in COVID and can't find on the shelves early on, are being put there by immigrants. So there's so many essential workers that right now are immigrants that are helping us through this really challenging time. So I try to tell people, focus on that. And, you know, I'm going to share a very interesting story with you, Aaron, because I don't get to, outside of Congress, share very much. In Congress, we do these behind-the-scenes private meetings with our colleagues on the other side. And what's astounding to me is when they tell me stories privately about somebody who came into their household, who was an immigrant, maybe undocumented, who helped when they had their child, and what that immigrant and that person means to their family. And I want to tell my colleague, and I have, share your story on how you've also relied on immigrants, and in some cases, undocumented immigrants. Don't make them criminals. And that's something that's very hard, because politics then comes in, and I hear, I can't share that story in my district. And that's really heart-wrenching.
What was it like to see then-candidate Trump coming down an escalator, and then the rhetoric he used that was so cruel and dehumanizing about Mexicans being rapists and drug dealers, and that gross generalization of taking an entire swath of the Latinx community and just stereotyping them as Mexicans and in a really derogatory term?
Well, I think it was hurtful for me personally, for our communities, but it also began to instill hate and division in this country. And we have seen since then, the former president likes to use immigrants as his scapegoat. When something's not going right or doesn't know what to talk about, he goes right back to bashing immigrants. And what it has led to over the course of years was this violent domestic terror attack that we saw in El Paso, where you had somebody who wasn't even from El Paso drive there and commit a shooting at the Walmart, killed so many. That is what happens when we instill hate and division, and when you have the leader of the free world repeating those lies, characterizing immigrants that way. We can't let that happen again. We just cannot.
What I honor that you did is travel throughout the border states when families were being separated and kids and babies were being put in cages. So can you tell our audience, which is global, what that was like to be a caring humanitarian and a leader to feel so powerless and helpless with these children in cages?
Well, I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed and I was hurt that this was happening in our country and that you really couldn't do a lot. And I'll never forget, and I was on the southern border and I was in a facility and there was a young girl. I got on my knee to talk to her and her mother says to me, my daughter is a U.S. citizen. She was born in New York and she's in a facility that is not for citizens. And I was shocked. And the first thing I said was, can you prove it? And she had her passport with her. And the only way that I was able to get something done is I took a picture and I went public with it, because the public outrage got them to release the mother and the child. But it shouldn't take that. It shouldn't take a member of Congress being in a facility, going public. But that's what it was like under the prior administration. And the conditions that we saw in those facilities were pretty inhumane. And that's just on top of the separation that was happening You know, we've seen kids and families traumatized for life from the separation. Many of these kids thought their parents left them by their own accord, didn't realizing that they were forcibly separated. And I can't even imagine what that does to a young child who made the journey, in many cases a dangerous journey, to be separated. And then what was really heartbreaking were the very young kids who they were not allowed to be touched. They were not allowed to be cradled. And when kids cry and they're that young, they need that attention. They need that emotional connection. And we saw in custody kids who were not allowed to be touched or given that affection they needed. And what that does to their development and the trauma is just, it's unimaginable.
What was it like to be inside those detention centers and be able to be face-to-face with children and actually communicate in their native language and to hear their stories firsthand, that it wasn't censored, that it wasn't, that they didn't try to twist and turn it on the news? You were there face-to-face speaking with these children.
Well, it was hard because we were told not to talk to the children or to the parents. And so sometimes we would have to defy the officials and say, look, we're members of Congress. We're here to investigate. And so sometimes you would get pieces and stories. Other times in some of the facilities where they keep kids, you got the sense that maybe they let you see the kids, like selected kids. But to hear their stories on the ones you are able to talk to explain to them, first, that it's okay to trust me. Because so far, everybody they've encountered is somebody they can't trust. And so to be able to talk to them in Spanish and say, you know, I'm here to try to help. Most of them were asking about their parents and when can they go home and crying and parents that were begging for help.
I loved every time I turned on the news and saw you, your righteous indignation, because it is righteous indignation. I think you were allowed a firsthand glimpse there, but then you brought us in to that scene. So what was some of the most outrageous things that you saw?
I think the conditions, the living conditions, these are prisons. These are not meant for children, and certainly not very young children. The unsanitary conditions, people living in tents, the smell when you walked in of what was, you know, people who didn't have air conditioning. They were in the heat. They were in the cold and didn't have, you know, enough to keep them warm, not showering, not having access to simple things like diapers. Or in one case, the mother who would say, we're getting one diaper a day. And what is that doing to the child? And that's just not how you treat a human being. So it was very hard, and it still is. Those are images that stay with you, and maybe for some good, because they're a constant reminder of how un-American that is and how we can't allow that to happen, regardless of who's in power. Under this administration, I'm going to be just as vocal in making sure that we're, you know, keeping families together and that we're providing humanitarian standards at the southern border.
Speaking of the border, tell us about your new position and how things will be different now that you have a leadership position.
So I'm now serving as the chairwoman of the Subcommittee on Homeland for the border, which is amazing to me to have that opportunity to do that. But I get to run the meetings. I get to decide what hearings we're going to have on border issues. And under this administration, that's huge because we have the ability to have hearings about what is happening at these, I call them jails. They're called detention centers, but they are jails. And if you go look at them, they're no different than jails. To look at the conditions, to see what's happening, how do we move away from that into alternatives to detention? Looking at programs like the Remain in Mexico program, where completely inhumane program when you're keeping migrants down in dangerous conditions where people are being raped, they're being killed, they're being used by the cartels. And so we've seen the current administration move to eliminate it. But there's a lot of work to do on that, on reuniting families and making sure there isn't separation continuing to happen, because the reality is that there are different ways to separate families. And one of those is through what the last administration did. And the other way, frankly, is when you are starting to deport people who've been here for decades, have all their families here, you deport them. Now you're separating a family and you're breaking up a family. So we need to find better ways to address the immigration system. That's something I think you're going to see in the coming weeks in Congress as well.
You think your time in the courtroom as a fierce attorney is going to help you be the chairwoman of this committee?
No doubt. Very helpful. Because you quickly recognize that in Congress you have limited time, maybe 5 minutes to ask questions. As a chairwoman, I'll have more latitude now. But knowing how to ask the right questions, trying to get the right information out, is all going to be very helpful. And then you still have to deal with your colleagues on the other side. I see it as opposing counsel on these issues, and we're still having to correct the misleading information being put out there is something we're going to have to continue to do. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Speaking of your colleagues on the other side, we are all just reeling with the acquittal. And for someone who was in Washington on January 6th to count those votes and to fortify an election, can you tell us about what that was like to be there? And do you have post-traumatic stress disorder now from what you saw and experienced that all of us watched on television?
So the fascinating thing about January 6th is we were all warned. And we were told to come early that day to try to stay off the streets. And we all thought that there was going to be plenty of security. There was no way security was going to be breached. On my way into the office, a lot more streets were closed off, and we knew something was wrong. And I was actually scheduled to be on the House, in the House chamber at 2 p.m. And this happened right around 2:20, 2:25. I was running late. And thank goodness I was running late that day. Because as I was getting ready to walk, I was told they had just evacuated one of the nearby buildings and that I should go back to my office. And shortly thereafter, we heard the intercom system, which has never been used, Aaron, before that I ever remember. A woman came on saying, shelter in place, lock your door, stay away from the windows. Now, kids have drills at schools. We don't have these drills with members. And so this, for me, was completely new. And then when you looked up at the images on the news that they had breached security, they were in the Capitol, and all our buildings are connected by tunnels. And so it was the fear starts to set in of, are they going to come looking for members? We would hear people in the hallways, and we didn't know if they were the rioters or if they were friendlies. So it was just a lot of fear. I feel lucky in the sense I had two members of my staff with me. We barricaded the door. And I didn't have the experience of being on the floor when the shot was fired, when members were struggling to put their gas masks on and they couldn't even get the plastic open. But there are many, many members and staff who, you know, we have meetings to hear people out and to have health experts tell people it's okay not to feel okay. And to try to get through this tough time, because the reality is that now members are also afraid of some of the other members, which is a whole different trauma and stress. And, you know, you have members of Congress now wearing bulletproof vests, something I never thought I would see or experience in my time in Congress, not in this country.
I have an amazing question from Alexis. She is a student at Chapman University, and she's also Jewish. And Alexis asked, how did you feel during the riot at the Capitol when you saw people wearing an Auschwitz camp shirt or other shirts that said 6 million was not enough in the halls of the Capitol, a place that represents freedom from being oppressed?
And think about it now, and it's hard not to break down and cry. It's really hard to think about the hate that these people were feeling and that they do feel. You know, we thought that was a chapter passed in this country. And we learned on January 6th, not only are these feelings out there that people have of hate and division, but then to put on a shirt and a sweater like that to come to the Capitol, where we are fighting for equality, we're fighting against the discrimination, fighting to make sure something like that never happens again, was a real stain on our country. I try to think about it and say, look, this was a selected few, but we can't ignore that there is anti-Semitism and that there is discrimination and that there are some people who are harboring these negative feelings that are leading to violence, which is why it's so important that we call it out when we see it, that we do not tolerate it, because we cannot go down the road of saying this is okay. We need to put an end to it as quickly as possible.
When you saw the flags that were antithetical to everything you believe, whether it was a Confederate flag or a white supremacist flag, what did that feel like in a place of homage where you work every day in the rotunda? How did that make you feel?
Well, it was really disrespectful, and it desecrated the people's house as something that we as a body try day in and day out to disown and to change. So it was very hard to see the images and to not understand why somebody wasn't there to stop them and to have these images that will live in history now. And what is that going to tell us about that point in time in our history when we thought that we were moving away from Confederate flags? You know, we were moving away to rename military bases, but this was a lot more than that, clearly. You know, it was the rise of white supremacy again, and it was very hurtful. And then if you didn't see the images, of course, who was cleaning up the mess afterward? It was janitorial staff, African-American. Just brought back those feelings of, you know, the struggle that we've had and that we are still fighting against to get equality in this country.
I love the image of your colleague who was pacing, and then he actually went down the rotunda and cleaned up. Have you had a chance to see those images of him literally on his hands and knees picking up the shards of flagpoles that were desecrated or water bottles? But he, as a Congress member, just felt like, I have to do something.
So I'm not sure which images those are. I've seen some of Andy Kim.
Yeah, it was Andy Kim.
From New Jersey. And it was very emotional to see that, because to speak to him about it, and what he was thinking, what was going through his mind, is here he is a relatively newer member in the sense. And when he came to Congress, I don't think he ever thought he would be cleaning up a mess and a destruction, really, of the Capitol. But it was a reminder, too. It was good to see that we're all in this together. And no matter who we are, we're all going to do our part in picking up the pieces.
When you think of PTSD and colleagues who are wearing a bulletproof vest and other colleagues such as AOC who get death threats, what does that feel like when you go to work and you're fighting the good fight, or as John Lewis would encourage you, getting into good trouble, that there's this other element of fear and danger?
You know, death threats are very real, and when you get them, they're very scary. Members of Congress, we don't have a security detail. We don't get followed into a grocery store, home, have somebody camped out at our house. And that means we are completely vulnerable. I mean, just take a look at Gabby Giffords. And so getting a death threat is very scary and traumatizing, that the thing that you're standing up for and fighting for is what's causing people to hate you and then threaten your life. We have seen a number of members, they happen to be women, a lot of women of color, who are receiving death threats. And it's heartbreaking, because we should not tolerate it. whether you're a Democrat or Republican, we should all stand up against any kind of death threats. When Steve Scalise got shot on the baseball field, we weren't thinking, oh, good, he's a Republican. Oh, he's a Republican. No, he was one of us. And that's how we should look at these, is for democracy to work, for it to work right, we cannot allow that to continue. And we need to stand up and make sure that we're calling it out when it happens. But it's heartbreaking when one of your colleagues is the subject of death threats.
You think it will be possible to have unification in the next term after an acquittal and after censures and everything that's happening post January 6th?
There are factors that are going to make it more challenging, especially when you have so many of my colleagues who decided that they were willing to try to overturn this election. So it will be harder, but there are some Republicans we can work with. And at the end of the day, we need to ask ourselves, what can we get done for the American people? Because this is about the American people. This is about making progress. So in the case this week, we're trying to push, you know, COVID relief bill. And if we can get Republicans on board, then great. And I happen to think, even though they're opposing it now, when it comes down to it, we are going to get Republicans to vote for this because their constituents need help and are in need. And we're hearing that from Republican governors and mayors and elected officials on the ground. And so hopefully that pressure will help our colleagues in Congress do the right thing.
Speaking of COVID, I have some wonderful questions from some college students about COVID. Leslie De La Torre, she's also a student at University of California, Irvine. And she wanted to ask you a question about COVID and schools. She said, since COVID closed down all the schools and now some schools are starting to reopen, how do you think students who are struggling with inconsistent school schedules, especially smaller children who don't understand what's going on, how will they acclimate to these changes?
Well, it's not easy. It's not easy for parents or for students. And we need to move as quickly as we can to reopening schools safely. I'm trying to make up for that time, the lost time. But we have to also keep in mind that we're trying to keep everybody safe. So having that home structure is helpful to have, but not everybody has it. And we also know there are some students who are having a very hard time now because maybe in the own household is where you're having, you know, domestic violence and family issues. It's making it hard for kids. So we need to make sure that their services are available for our students, but we're moving as quickly as we can to reopen so that they can adjust as much as possible. We also have the lack of access and equal access, and we know that some kids are being left behind because of the digital divide, because of the lack of support in their homes, and so it's in our interest to get kids in schools as quickly as possible.
This goes along with that question. It's from Fabiola Alejandres, University of California, Irvine student, and she's very interested in mental health. So she wanted to know, Congressman Merrigan, mental health is important and should be taken into consideration. Is there a possibility that mental health resources are included in the next COVID package? And do you think there'll be funding for resources for mental health?
Absolutely. We just had a hearing the other day, and the very issue of mental health services and investing more in mental health is critically needed and is included in the American Rescue Plan, which is the next COVID bill. Suicides are up. Depression is up. People are struggling and having to isolate. Not having social interaction isn't helping the situation either. So we recognize that, and there is going to be an investment in mental health in the next bill. And let me say one thing. I'd say it all the time, and that is mental health doesn't have a lobby on the Hill like other groups do. So we as members need to make sure that we're pushing this issue because mental health impacts everybody. And it's tied to everything, to gun violence, to how we do in school, well, we do in school, and opportunities are available to us. And I tell people all the time, we all have mental health issues. The question is, to what degree? It's okay to ask for help. It's okay not to feel okay, but we are investing in the next bill.
Appreciate that. This student, he is actually a high school student. He is going to follow in your footsteps. He is the student body president, second year in a row, and he's only a junior.
Wow.
His family proudly hails from the country of Nepal. And his question was about healthcare. He said, You know, he was very lucky that his mom had a good job and they had health care. And with COVID, she lost her job. And as a family, they were terrified during this COVID crisis what would happen to the family. So his question was really about health care for those that are really struggling, especially immigrants or folks who don't have health care tied to their jobs. Can you talk about how you personally fight for health care for all?
This is something I know that the administration cares deeply about, which is why you've seen the reopening of the enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act, because we want to make sure people who have lost their jobs have the ability to maybe get health care under the Affordable Care Act. That's something that the prior administration didn't advertise, really didn't have a open period or want to keep it open. But people who have lost their jobs, this is an opportunity for them to go on to the exchange and see if they can get health care under the subsidized system, because this is not the time for people to be losing their health care. We also have to make sure that there's options, so clinics are available, and there's other means for people to get access to care. It is a very challenging time, but health care is at the top of one of my priorities, and it is as well for this president and administration.
Adrian is a student from UC Irvine, and he is contemplating whether he wants to be a clinical therapist or if he wants to be a social worker. But as a proud Angeleno, he has noticed that homelessness is on the rise. And he just wanted to ask you a question. He said, homelessness in the U.S. seems to be a huge issue, especially in major cities like my own, Los Angeles. And with homelessness rates rising immensely, it seems as if we're only providing the bare minimum for the disadvantaged. Congressman Berrigan, what are some possible strategies that can be supported in order to help eliminate the surge of homelessness? And is it possible to eliminate it as a whole?
Absolutely. But it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of time, and there's not going to be an easy overnight fix on fixing homelessness. Number one, we have to invest in affordable housing. Housing costs are skyrocketing. People can't afford to pay their rent. COVID now, people are losing their jobs. We can't afford to make it worse and have more people become homeless. So we need to invest in affordable housing. We need to invest in mental health services and wraparound services for people. You know, many times people think that if you see somebody that's homeless on the street, it's because they want to be there or because you know, they did something terrible, but that's not usually the situation. If you go in and talk to people, sometimes they're students that are homeless. Sometimes somebody had one trip to the emergency room and got left with a huge bill because they didn't have insurance, and they got a real setback because of health insurance costs. Health insurance costs should never put you on the street or make you homeless. And that's part of our broken healthcare system. But we have to make sure that we recognize the high cost in housing, that we need to provide mental health services as well as wraparound services. We need to take care of our veterans when they come back from overseas and sometimes maybe have PTSD. And we need to invest more in services for folks who are struggling with addiction. And instead of putting them in a jail, you are providing the help that they need to get through so that they're not going to end up on the street. So there's a lot we can do. A lot of it is tied to mental health. And we also need to have jobs. We need to have jobs that provide a living wage. You know, the minimum wage hasn't increased in a very long time, but we should have jobs where you, if you have a job, you can afford to have a roof over your head. And that's just not the case still.
In a county that is striving to be at $15 an hour for minimum wage in California, why are your colleagues across the country so resistant to a spike in minimum wage?
So we see that a lot more in the Midwestern states where the cost of living may be lower, maybe they're paying their folks less money. But it's hard in when you look at the country. You know, California has a high cost of living, New York has a high cost of living, that even $15 an hour is not going to get you by. And so there is that resistance that, you know, businesses will lead the effort on, and then it's hard to make that progress. But, you know, we are fighting to get the $15 minimum wage into the next COVID bill. And The House is going to send it to the Senate. The big question will be whether the Senate parliamentarian decides whether it's germane or not and keeps it in. So we're going to make that effort. And, you know, we have to invest in people. That's what a minimum wage will do.
This next question is from Caden, who's Canadian, and he's a graduate of Waldorf University. And what I love about talking to Caden is he doesn't quite understand our government. And if I was an outsider looking in, I wouldn't understand it either. But he wanted to go backwards to go forwards. His father is Aboriginal, and in Canada, they're trying to make amends with the treatment of the Aboriginal rights with residential schools and some of the horrific things that happened on the reserves in Canada. So his question to you was, what actions can the people of the United States take to inspire change in resources for economic and cultural growth for the Native American community?
The first thing is we have to recognize they were here first and that they were displaced, really. We need to do good. And the federal government is in charge and has the jurisdiction over tribes and our Native American people. And so we need to do our part in making sure. Sometimes it's an issue of they don't have access to enough resources on these tribal lands. I mean, I've gone to visit and you have seen the lack of access to health care, the lack of access to running water in some places. You've got companies coming in and bulldozing over these sacred pieces of land to build a pipeline, further endangering the water supply. So, you know, we have to stand up to make sure that they're getting the rights they deserve, but also really being paid back for what we've taken away. And so I think there are ways in Congress and some efforts being made to recognize certain tribes and in lands, making sure that they have the autonomy over their lands. Sometimes we come in and we want to change things up, but that's just not how it was set up to be. There's a lot of work to do, but making sure that they have access to some basic living supplies and necessary things like clean water, clean air, health care, investment in schools, all very important.
Since so many of our viewers are students, I want to go back to Nanette D.S. Berrigan in elementary school. Before you went to UCLA, and before you went to law school, and before you were a very successful attorney, what was Nanette like in elementary school? Because I want some kid to watch this today and say, I could be her in 20 years. So what were the traits that you had then? Were you sassy? Were you feisty? Did you stand up to the bully then on the playground so that you could stand up to a bully at the bully pulpit? Describe Nanette in elementary school.
So I was a big tomboy. I mean, that was my big thing. I was always walking around and being a little bit of a rebel. You know, when you're the daughter of immigrants, my mom would always say, oh, we don't ask questions. Like, we don't fight back. And I was the one that said, no, Mom, we have rights and we got to fight back. And that was early on in elementary school. And I think that was part of me witnessing what would happen to my parents when they went in to inquire about social services or, you know, their immigration status and moving citizenship along. And then I saw my parents disrespected because they were immigrants. So for me as a kid, it was just trying to learn as much as I could so that I could help stand up for my family one day. And I wouldn't say I was like a study, like a nerd or anything like that. Quite opposite. I was always playing athletics on the field. And you know, when I got to eighth grade, I wasn't doing very well in school. As a matter of fact, I had a 1.8 GPA. And so I tell kids all the time, you might be going through a tough period right now, but you can turn it around. I did. But I always asked a lot of questions. I was always very interested in learning from the days of the Civil War, what we did wrong and where we could do better in the civil rights period, because I'm a firm believer that that struggle is something that I experienced in my Latino heritage, is discrimination, that you look different, that didn't feel we were being treated the same. And so for me, it was a matter of as a kid, just trying to stand up for my parents and our family. And I think that just carried over into law school. And now, as a member of Congress, standing up for maybe those who are afraid to, or those who can't, or those who are working two jobs. People tell me, that's why I elected you, so you could go fight for me. So it's interesting to look back.
One of my last questions is for those high school students. You're first generation, and you had to apply to college. I know you went to UCLA. But what was that like, that process of daring to dream and dream big, that I will be the first? I will be the first to carry this family on a new trajectory.
Well, it was really scary because my parents didn't know anything about applying to college. And I just remember when I looked into it, I got a one-page document for UCs. And I just remember the advisor saying, all you have to do is check three schools that you want to apply to for free. And I remember my mom saying, I don't know how you're going to pay for it, but you got to go to college. And so I had to figure it out on my own. And that was, as a kid, very scary. I had to apply for loans with my parents' names because there was no way to do it otherwise. They would say, well, you need a parent loan. And I would go to my parents and I'd say, well, you need a parent loan. And they said, like, oh, whatever you need, go ahead and just do it. But they didn't know how to fill an application. My father had zero income. And they said, well, that's okay. He can still apply. And so I really had a very limited understanding of what it took to get into college and how to even apply, how to navigate the system. So we try in our office to tell families and kids, if you need help with the FAFSA form, with federal aid, call us, let us know. But we need to increase the amount of aid and grants we provide, because college should not leave you saddled with debt. And that is one thing that I remember going in, understanding that I was going to have to come out with debt. But it really is a disservice to our students, because I hear kids all the time saying, I can't afford to go to college. I said, you can't afford not to go to college. But we do have to make sure that it's affordable. And frankly, I think, you know, you shouldn't have to pay. At a minimum, community college should be free and something we should move toward. But I still look back and I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky that I navigated the system.
Speaking of the system, this is for parents and for teachers. We all watched on January 6th. And what would you like us to tell children and students who are confused and scared about what happened in our country? What are some lessons that we could take away from a congressperson who was there, who every single day is going to show up and stand up and speak up and speak out against injustice? What can we say on your behalf?
Oh, I think we got to tell kids that what happened that day was a stain on our history, but that we are going to come out stronger. And that is going to take us to stand up for democracy. And we need to stand up to hate. And we need to do the right thing. And sometimes doing the right thing is hard to do, especially in politics. But we need to put our country and the American people ahead of any one person and any hate. And that this is a work in progress. And that we are going to continue that work, and that we need them, our young people, to strive to be at the table and to be those representatives and to be those leaders that are not only going to show the example, but that are going to help us eliminate the hate, the discrimination, and hopefully one day to move beyond what we saw happening on the 6th. But it's going to take a lot of work, and we have to have the right people there and at the table.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Congresswoman Nanette Barragán, for taking the time to speak with us about so many important issues. Her commitment to not only her constituents, but for anyone who calls the United States home is a testament to the power of American democracy, and her inspiring story underscores the struggle that so many face to achieve the American dream. My dear listeners, may each of us encourage meaningful change in our own communities. May we fight together to protect the underserved, and may we all provide the opportunities for everyone to succeed, regardless of their situation. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.